From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. This morning, U.S. Attorney General Loretta Lynch acknowledged that an impromptu conversation she had on board her plane Monday with former President Bill Clinton cast a shadow on the work of the Department of Justice, and she wouldn't do it again. The work is the investigation into whether Hillary Clinton mishandled classified information by using a private email server. Lynch said she expects to accept whatever recommendations the career lawyers and FBI agents who are handling the case present to her.
I understand how people view it, and I think that because of that, and because of the fact that it has now cast a shadow over how this case may be perceived, no matter how it's resolved, it's important to make it clear that that meeting with President Clinton does not have a bearing on how this matter is going to be reviewed, resolved, and accepted by me.
So just the end of another week on the campaign trail with just a couple weeks to go until the political convention. So with that, let's get to our weekly wrap of 2016 politics.
Here and now.
2016.
Joining us now, Julie Mason, host of The Press Pool on Sirius XM. Hi, Julie.
Hey, guys, that never gets old.
And Jesse Holland, manager of social media for AP Politics. Jesse, welcome back to you as well.
Yeah, I love it, too. I always feel good hearing that.
Okay. Well, so we know some listeners, you know, are thinking maybe a new band, but we'll see. Jesse, I want to start with you and with Loretta Lynch. Now, there are a lot of people who, you know, thought she was actually sitting there sifting through the evidence and doing the investigation. She might have assuaged them by talking today to Jonathan Capehart at the Aspen Ideas Festival in Colorado about how, no, it's career lawyers who are doing this. But he pushed her to, you know, and she said, I'm not recusing myself. I do expect to accept the decision of the career lawyers, but also it's my job to review it. So is that going to put out the fires?
Absolutely not.
Okay.
The problem with Loretta Lynch meeting with Bill Clinton is just adds another layer to the people who are not going who want to see the Justice Department say Hillary Clinton absolutely positively did something wrong. All this does is give more ammunition to Hillary Clinton's opponents to say she's crooked, she did something wrong, and now the Obama administration is not going to punish her. The best thing Loretta Lynch could have done was not have that meeting, but now she has to find some type of way to get the stench of corruption, a possible corruption, off of what she did. Mm-hmm. And that's why you heard her say that today.
Mm-hmm. Julie, why did Bill Clinton have that meeting? Because it's almost riskier for him than for her.
Yeah, well, he does whatever he wants, as we've seen over and over again. And, you know, a couple of friends, he had appointed her to be attorney general years ago back in the 90s. They had a relationship going back. This wasn't like a nice to meet you kind of thing. But once again, it's another unforced error by the Democrats. And it's, you know, it was bad for the campaign at a time when Hillary Clinton has to maintain whatever she's doing in order to stay well above Donald Trump in the polls.
Speaking of Hillary Clinton, this was also a week that another big ongoing issue popped up, which was the Benghazi report that the Republicans have been working on now for a couple of years. They finally released it. It didn't have any new allegations of wrongdoing by Hillary Clinton, but at a women's luncheon in Chicago, she acknowledges that she has some work to do in convincing voters that she's trustworthy. Here she is.
You know, you hear 25 years worth of wild accusations, anyone would start to wonder. And it certainly is true. I've made mistakes. I don't know anyone who hasn't. So I understand people having questions.
Jesse, are those questions going to continue despite this report?
Of course. They're going to continue all the way through November. And if Hillary Clinton wins the presidency, they'll continue for at least 4 more years. It's one of those issues that once your political opponents have their teeth into it, they're not going to let it go. We're going to hear more and more about Benghazi for the next few months until the election. Then if she wins, we'll hear more about it I guarantee you there'll probably be at least a couple of more investigations of it. It's just one of those issues that the Republicans think their voters care about, and they're going to keep pushing it.
Yeah. Jesse, you've had all the easy questions. Your answer is right. Of course. Julie, I want you to take this next one. Donald Trump has continued to link Clinton to trade deals like NAFTA and the TPP. Let's listen.
The Trans-Pacific Partnership is another disaster done and pushed by special interests who want to rape our country just a continuing rape of our country. That's what it is, too. It's a harsh word. It's a rape of our country.
Okay. And Julie Mason.
What a charming analogy.
Well, you know, some people objected to the use of the word, which he sounded like he anticipated. But, you know, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce it came out and tweeting against him. I mean, this is, you know, he's bucking.
The Republican Party.
Yeah.
Yeah, the Republican Party is for that trade deal. If he's going to talk about who's against it, he ought to talk about the leaders of the party which he seeks to lead. Hillary Clinton, yeah, she was very instrumental in crafting or framing that trade deal. Now says she's not happy with it, which, you know, is a problem of her own, this perception that she's whichever way the wind blows on politics. But, you know, his problem isn't really with her on this as much as it is with his own party.
Yeah.
What about the really crazy Trump news this week, which was that BuzzFeed reported.
Well, how do you pick?
Yeah.
Which one?
No, this one I think actually rises above even many weeks of this, which is BuzzFeed reported that he had a phone console near his bed at his Mar-a-Lago resort that allowed him to listen in to anyone's phone calls at Mar-a-Lago when they were there. And then there's another story in the New York Times this week about the Trump Institute, this real estate seminars that he was putting on that used plagiarized material. Is any of this going to matter, Jesse or Julie?
Go ahead. Well, Julie, go ahead. I'll let you.
Julie, it's you. It's you, Julie.
Okay. All right. Well, that's part of the problem with Donald Trump, right? And there's been some great reporting in the Washington Post, too, by David Farenthold about his promises on donating to charity, which do not match his actual contributions. He actually took charitable donations to buy a Tim Tebow autographed helmet, and which normally, under normal circumstances, these would be the kind of stories that would sink a candidate. But with Donald Trump, there's always such a welter of crazy bad news that nothing really seems to land.
Well, there's also, you know, potentially more serious news, although I really want it confirmed whether or not he listened to people's phone calls as staying at his hotel.
Yeah, Jesse, do you have any thoughts on that, by the way?
I assume he did.
Well, it's one of those
workers
weird things.
Workers say he did, yeah.
Yeah, it's one of those weird things where if he did, how could you this guy be the nominee? But it doesn't like Julie said, nothing seems to stick. Are we getting into controversy fatigue with Donald Trump? Well, nothing seems to stick.
Well, what about the being criticized for moments like this on the campaign trail in New Hampshire yesterday? Let's listen.
Why aren't we putting our military retirees on that border or in TSA? Get rid of all these heebie-jobbies they wear at TSA.
Well,
I've seen them myself.
I understand.
We need
that.
The veterans back in there to take it. They've fought for this country and defended it. They'll still do it.
You know, Julie, both of you.
And we are looking at that.
He says, we're looking at that. And it brings to mind to many the John McCain moment where he took the microphone away from the woman who said that Barack Obama was a Muslim. He said, no, ma'am, no. Here he does not push back on that. But here's where there are a lot of Americans who are, you know, they don't consider themselves racist, they don't consider themselves xenophobic, but they are a little concerned about Muslims working at the airport, and they don't know what to do with that. I mean,
and here's an opportunity for a leader, for a confident leader, to step up and say, you know what, some of our vets wear the hijab and served in wars for us, and they needed a job, and you know, et cetera. It's an opportunity to educate, not to validate.
Yeah, Jesse.
Well, and that's the problem that a lot of people are seeing right now, including some of the Republicans. Keep in mind, in 2012, they said that they needed to attract more minority to the party. And then you have their nominee like Donald Trump, who had an opportunity to say, we're not going to profile anyone right there. And he didn't say it. He just said, we'll look into it. That's not the image that a lot of Republicans want to see for their party in the future. But that's what Donald Trump's doing.
Julie, why has Bernie Sanders not endorsed Hillary Clinton yet?
Does he still think
there's a chance he's going to be the nominee?
Well, what a miscalculation by Bernie Sanders. We're up to, it's almost a month now that he's been withholding his endorsement, awaiting concessions. He has completely lost his moment. He overinterpreted his mandate, overplayed his hand, and now he's pretty irrelevant.
But some of his followers may not think that. They think, good for you, hold out for the platform committee.
Okay, thousands of people are disenchanted. Well, I mean, that's America. She doesn't need him anymore. That's the thing. She is plowing on without him. There was a time when there was some, okay, well, let's see what Bernie wants and what we can do for him. And now it's like, dude, forget it.
And why all this talk about the platform committee, by the way? Does anybody care what the party platform is at the convention?
Apparently
really?
Only Bernie Sanders.
I guess.
Only
Bernie Sanders. Yeah, exactly.
I don't know. I think there have been some battles that about platforms that have led to later, you know, changes in policy and legislation. You know, I think gay rights and things like that. And, you know, I
but not because it was on the platform.
Yeah, but yeah,
that's,
you could,
where, that's where the fights start. Come on.
Well, anyway, this platform was unanimously approved, including by the Sanders people.
Yeah. Julie, just quick on the Veep stakes. Any, is there going to be any news there?
It's going to be so underwhelming. I'm so underwhelmed. I know all the choices are boring and horrible.
Okay. Oh. All right. Okay.
Can you tell a holiday's coming?
Yes. Yeah. Yes. That's Jesse Holland, manager of the AP Politics social media accounts. Julie Mason, host of the Press Pool on Sirius XM. We wish you both.
Happy 4th of July, guys.
Happy holiday.
Very happy.
Thank you.
New numbers out today show that U.S. manufacturing expanded in June at the fastest clip in more than a year. A bit of good news for an industry that historically in this country has been a male-dominated one. But the share of American men between the ages of 25 and 54 who are neither working nor looking for work has doubled since the 1970s. In fact, roughly one in six of those men are either unemployed or out of the workforce altogether. For a closer look at what's going on, we're joined by Derek Thompson, senior editor at The Atlantic. He joins us each week. Hi, Derek.
Hi, Jeremy.
So we know there's been a decline in manufacturing in this country, which used to employ a lot of these working-age men, but that's not the whole story here, is it?
No, it's not. The disappearance of prime-age men, as you said, is one of the most intriguing economic mysteries in the country right now. You have millions of men who should be working in the economy, or at least looking for work, but they aren't. And economists aren't really sure why. There are two big explanations that I think go the farthest in terms of answering this question. The first is, as you said, deindustrialization, the disappearance of manufacturing, which has been an enormous story since the 1970s. The second really important story, I think, is prison. The U.S. has the highest incarceration rate in the developed world. And you have millions of men who have left prison and find it really difficult to be re-employed in the economy. And so I think when you combine these factors, the disappearance of manufacturing jobs on the one hand and the difficulty of post-incarceration employment on the other hand, that probably goes the furthest towards explaining where did all these men go.
And some would say that another explanation would be that more of these men are on disability, that they're collecting those benefits.
That's right. There is this program, Social Security Disability Insurance, which a lot of conservatives think is a major driving force in men leaving the workforce. It should be said that when you look at the demographics of these men, they are disproportionately black, disproportionately less educated, and they're concentrated in the South. The number of these men who have signed up for disability payments in the last few decades has tripled. It's not likely, a lot of economists say, that the actual disability rate itself has tripled. What you have essentially are a lot of men that I've described who are so frustrated with the economy that, they're trying to get a paycheck from the government, which happens to keep them from working full time. So it is an explanation. It is absolutely something that conservatives talk about. But I don't think that it is the driving force here.
So is there an economic impact on the rest of us, those of us who are working, from these people who are not working, have left the labor force, or is it just a terrible story for them?
It's not just a story for them. It really is a national story. We're all in this together. The unemployment rate has gone down by quite a lot in the last few years. It's now around 5%, and that's low. But at the same time, people look at wages and the lack of wage growth and the fact that the economy isn't growing, and they think, well, how on the one hand could we have an economy with a really low unemployment rate, but it also seems to be not sort of pumping at it at its full capacity? One of the answers is that we have all of this labor slack. We have all of these men who should be working, but they're not. So this issue of these millions of missing prime-age men is very much a national economic issue.
And this is where we get to what I think is the really interesting thing about what you have described in The Atlantic, and we'll link people to that at hereandnow.org about this, which is that there is a solution for the government to step in here and help get some of these men back to work.
Yeah, this was something that I thought long and hard about. There were sort of two stories that were circling around in my head. On the one hand, the story of the millions of missing men that we've been talking about. On the other hand, that we need millions of new construction workers to build homes in dense metro areas on the coast, to build homes in the suburbs for all these millennials to move into. And it occurred to me that what if we could find some way, some sort of government voucher program, to pay these men so that they could work as construction workers and build the homes that we need? It seems to me that that would be the sort of solution that would sort of solve two problems at once. On the one hand, putting these men back to work, growing the economy. On the other hand, solving some of the major housing shortages that we have across the country.
And I can't help but think, as I hear you describe this problem and the potential solution, that this feeds into a lot of the political unrest that we see, not just in this country, but also overseas, and especially with the news about Brexit, that a lot of these people are the ones who are so angry about the influx of immigrant labor who are coming in and taking jobs when they can't find one themselves.
That's right. You look at the maps of the Brexit vote and you look at the difference between London, which voted overwhelmingly to remain, versus some of the counties to the north that voted overwhelmingly to leave. And then you look at the same geographical inequalities that we have in the U.S. You have this Rust Belt and the Southeast. And then you compare that to the metro areas, which are relatively booming. And you think, is there some way that we can get some of these men who are fallow and move them closer to areas where productivity is high? It's a really, really difficult challenge, but I think it's one that we need to pay more attention to.
That's Derek Thompson, senior editor at The Atlantic, who joins us each week on Here and Now. Derek, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Well, starting today in Vermont, nearly all food labels must reveal whether they include genetically engineered ingredients. The so-called GMO labeling law is the first of its kind in the country. There is a move in Washington to enact national standards, even as federal authorities argue genetically engineered products already meet the same safety requirements as food that is not genetically engineered. Kathleen Masterson of Here Now contributor Vermont Public Radio takes a look at what it means for a plant to be genetically engineered.
First, let's talk about the term GMO, or genetically modified organism.
Genetic modification, what does that mean? We've been modifying plants since way prehistory.
That's Jean Harris. She's a plant biologist at the University of Vermont. She prefers the term genetic engineering, which is what's used in the Vermont law. We'll hear more from her later. But when it comes to precisely defining the term, that's where it gets murky for both scientists and shoppers.
Scientifically adjusting the makeup of plants and, you know, typically plants usually.
So it's basically scientists taking the best parts of food and putting them together to either make them resistant to pesticides, animals.
You know, so like adding a gene from some kind of bacteria or other animal to a tomato or something to give it that quality.
That's Martha McLaughlin, Dakota Cashy, and Jamie Kearney outside a Burlington grocery store. And you know what? They're all kind of right. But for a precise definition, I asked an expert. Richard Amasino is a biochemist at University of Wisconsin-Madison. He's also on a committee at the National Academy of Sciences, which produced a recent report on genetic engineering.
We didn't focus too much on the definition of genetic engineering, but we spent a couple hours just realizing that we just can't really draw a line anywhere.
For the purposes of labeling, though, it had to be defined. Jean Harris gave this basic definition.
Genetic engineering means using tools of modern technology to genetically modify plants.
And that jibes with how Vermont's labeling law defines it, more or less. But the thing is, there are methods of adding, deleting, and duplicating the DNA of a plant that are not considered genetic engineering under the legal definition. For example, here's Harris's colleague, Jill Preston, describing a process called mutagenesis.
So we can use chemical mutagens or UV or something like that that will actually make nucleotide changes within genes and maybe disrupt their function or change their function.
To be clear, this technique doesn't involve inserting new or foreign genes into the plant. It's more like
kind of what evolution does. We have mutations happening all the time. This is just more, you know, directed by humans.
To make these changes, scientists either blast a plant's DNA with radiation or use a chemical that disrupts the DNA. That's not unlike when sunlight radiates DNA and causes mutations. Scientists are just speeding up the process. But just like evolution, it's random. So there's no way for scientists to know what kind of genetic changes will result. So I ask plant biologist Jean Harris, is mutagenesis actually riskier than just genetically modifying one gene?
I don't think it's riskier. It's just that it's totally untargeted.
Mutagenesis has been used in various forms for decades. In fact, foods that we eat today, like some kinds of rice, oats, lettuce, and ruby red grapefruits, come from seeds created through this process. And Harris says from a science perspective, she thinks it makes sense not to consider this technique genetic engineering, since it's mimicking nature's process. Canada and the European Union, on the other hand, do make a distinction. Canada considers plants produced with mutagenesis to be genetically modified, and European authorities will not allow them to be labeled organic. But scientists I talk to say we should not focus so much on how the crop was created, but instead look at the end product. Here's Richard Amasino.
One could, in a laboratory, change a couple nucleotides in a gene, and one could also accomplish that through mutagenesis. And the products would be identical, yet, at least by regulatory definitions that presently exist, one would be genetic engineering and one would not be.
Amasino and other scientists say the real scientific issue with respect to human health or safety of ecosystems is revealed by studying the product, not the route by which we got there. In the meantime, processed foods are already arriving on grocery shelves with the genetic engineering label, which may tell consumers a bit more than they knew before about how their food was made. For Here and Now, I'm Kathleen Masterson in Colchester, Vermont.
A deadly car crash in Florida in May is making national headlines today because 40-year-old Joshua Brown died while driving his Tesla Model S on autopilot. It's believed to be the first accident involving autopilot at a time when the industry is investing in self-driving cars. Michael Regan is a columnist for Bloomberg Gadfly in New York. Mike, it was reportedly sunny out. Apparently neither Tesla car cameras saw a tractor trailer making a left turn on the upcoming stretch of road until it was too late. Now, this is being investigated, but how is this autopilot on Tesla supposed to work?
Well, it's really meant to be hands-free driving, almost like the autopilot on a jet airliner. And it uses cameras, radar, and sensors to detect when the car should turn or hit the brakes. A company called Mobileye makes the technology that's being used by Tesla and some of the other automakers that are working on these self-driving cars. They actually came out with a statement saying that their system is designed to brake automatically to avoid rear-end collisions. In other words, if a car stops abruptly in front of you. But it's not able to brake for a vehicle that's crossing laterally in front of a car like this until 2018. So for now, it seems like a flaw that they'll have to possibly hustle out a fix for.
Well, first of all, we're getting that word out, you know, if you happen to drive one of these cars. But you say that the autopilot, you know, is supposed to be hands-free. But it's not. According to Tesla, the autopilot, when it comes on, shows drivers a message that they still have to hold onto the wheel at all times and maintain control and responsibility of the car. It sounds like Tesla is wanting to, you know, give a lot of that responsibility to the driver. But meantime, what does this mean for Tesla? How's the market reacting?
Well, initially, the stock market reacted pretty sharply. There was a big dip in the stock in after-hours trading yesterday. But today, in the regular trading, it's recovered. The last I checked, Tesla shares were actually up. Mm-hmm. So the market doesn't seem to be too concerned about this. That said, it is possible they'll have to recall all the cars that they've sold with autopilot. Though they're only approved in a handful of states, so it's not, you know, a huge part of their sales right. So far.
Well, and tell us more about the non-disclosure agreements that apparently Tesla had people sign who were buying the Model S.
Oh, right. Well, earlier this month, the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration came out and said it was looking into a separate issue with the suspension of the Model S, the Tesla Model S. And at that time, it came out that Tesla had been asking buyers to sign a non-disclosure agreement to discourage them from reporting safety problems in exchange for Tesla covering some of the repairs, the costs to repair the car. Mm-hmm. After a lot of publicity surrounding that, Tesla has since revised the agreements. So it did cause them a lot of bad publicity there
for
a bit.
Well, and you know, there's a big move to not call things accidents when, in fact, maybe there is something that could have been done. And as you said, there might be a recall. So this is a crash. Just briefly, what do you think it's going to do about, you know, the moves to get other cars, BMW, new self-driving car available in 2021?
All the reaction I've read today indicates that it's most likely will slow the rollout of more self-driving cars, though it's a pretty interesting debate because many people, Elon Musk, the CEO of Tesla especially, believe that these self-driving cars actually will be safer than human-driven cars. Tesla pointed out that over 130 million miles were driven on autopilot before one fatality, which is much longer than it takes for human-driven cars.
Michael Regan of Bloomberg Gadfly, thanks as always.
Thank you, Robin.
And as we approach Independence Day, we want to take a look back at a little-known part of the history of our independence, a group of brave soldiers from Maryland that charged British troops back in August of 1776 in the Battle of Brooklyn and allowed General George Washington's forces to fight another day. Combat historian Patrick O'Donnell has written a number of books about modern warfare, including the Battle of Fallujah in Iraq in 2004. He was embedded with the Marines who fought in that battle. But he turns his attention now to the Revolutionary War in his new book, Washington's Immortals, the untold story of an elite regiment who changed the course of the revolution. He joins us from Washington. Welcome.
Thanks for having me, Jeremy.
So a lot has been written about the Revolutionary War, but until now, not this story. How did you come across it?
About 6 years ago, I was asked by the commanding officer of 3-1, who is in the Battle of Fallujah with me, what I wanted to do in New York City. And he asked if I wanted to go see the Met, and I said, no, how about we go do a battlefield tour of Brooklyn? And we met at Greenwood Cemetery, where the battle began, the largest battle of the American Revolution begins outside of the gates of Greenwood Cemetery, which at that time was a watermelon patch, interestingly enough, in the Red Lion Inn. And we visited that site. We visited the site of Battle Hill, walked up and down the streets and alleys of Brooklyn, and found an old stone house where really one of the epic small unit engagements in American history occurred. 400 Marylanders charged multiple times into this stone house, which was occupied by Cornwallis, through, you know, braving canister and grape, walking over the bodies of their own men to basically create an opening in the British lines that allowed the American army to escape. And I was fascinated by what happened at that house. And then we walked a couple blocks further down the road, and I found a rusted old sign that said, "Here lie 256 Continental soldiers, Maryland heroes." The mass grave of the men that made this charge. These men are buried somewhere in Brooklyn under a street or in an empty lot. And I became fascinated. I became obsessed with finding the story behind that sign, who these men were. And I started putting together tiny threads, and this is the first time the Marylander story has been told in Washington's Immortals.
But how on earth, once you discover this story, do you go about finding out more details about it? This is something that happened more than 200 years ago at this point.
This was a giant, like, picture of kind of a Roman mosaic that had been shattered into thousands of pieces. And I kind of felt like an archaeologist putting together tiny pieces of this jigsaw puzzle through pension files, through diaries and letters. And I went all around the world to find their story. This is the first kind of Band of Brothers style history. And what I mean by that, it's the main officers and men of the Maryland line and their entire war beginning in 1774 in a small tavern where these men organized and formed the first independent company called the Baltimore Independent Cadets. They were known as men of family, fortune, and honor. And they were the richest men of Baltimore at the time that basically committed treason. They sacrificed their fortunes, in many cases their lives, to form this small independent company, which then blossoms into the first Maryland Regiment, or Smallwood's Battalion initially, and then later on into some of the greatest fighting regiments of the American Revolution. These men fought in nearly every major battle during the war, beginning in Brooklyn, where these men were America's Spartans, basically. This was our 300 moment, where these men basically charged and sacrificed their lives to save the American army that day. It was a pivotal time. Basically, the war could have been snuffed out had it not been for the sacrifices of these men. And it's my goal has been to tell their story and bring awareness to, you know, who they were. And in the process, this book tells the story of who we are as Americans.
Well, and some of their missions were basically suicide missions.
The term used during the American Revolution is the forlorn hope.
Right.
The Marylanders led many of the forlorn hopes. in the first ranks usually consisted of enlisted men that were armed only with axes to cut apart an atabey. What an atabey was the equivalent of 18th century barbed wire at the time. It's sharpened logs and sticks that typically ringed a fortress or fortification. And these men had to cut through that with their axes, and they were only armed with just axes to lead the assault force. And many of the Marylanders had some of the most difficult missions of the war. For instance, at a place called Stony Point. The anniversary of that is on July 15th, 1779. It's coming up.
We're speaking with historian Patrick O'Donnell, whose new book is called Washington's Immortals, The Untold Story of an Elite Regiment Who Changed the Course of the Revolution. And why, Patrick O'Donnell, didn't the British do more to quash this rebellion?
They pretty much did everything they could. They brought over tens of thousands of troops. They hired Hessian mercenaries. And in many cases, the British Empire had crushed nearly every rebellion that it ever encountered. And the men of the Marylanders were committing treason to fight for what they believed in their cause. And it's their resilience that we see through 8 long years of war. These men marched 4,600 miles in just a 2.5-year period. Many of these men had never been paid. They also had to face the first civil war. And what I mean by that is there were about a third of the colonies were loyal to the crown. I looked at the war not only as a conventional war, but also an insurgency. That's why these men arguably, I've written 7 books on World War II, and I've interviewed over 4,000 World War II veterans. I think they're the greatest generation because of what they had to overcome. Not only one of the most formidable and adaptable armies in the world, the British Army, but also fellow Americans. And that's, I think, an incredible achievement that they were able to do that. And it was also at the time the first – it was a global war. The American Revolution, which most people don't realize, was a global war once France becomes involved and the British have to protect their overseas territories and colonies, which bleeds troops off from North America. And this becomes a central portion of the American Revolution.
And General Washington relied heavily on these men from Maryland for so many missions. Was there something that you learned about George Washington in your research that you didn't know before you started?
You know, I think that our view of Washington is sort of trapped in the amber of oil paintings. And this is an incredible individual that in many cases led these men from the front. And one of my favorite stories is from a pension file. What I mean is after the war, if you were lucky enough to survive the revolution, you could go down to the local courthouse and swear under oath what you did. And one of my favorites is from Lawrence Everhart, Marylander Lawrence Everhart, who survives the battle of Fort Washington. And Fort Washington was a massacre where many of men were killed and captured. But he was able to find a rowboat and row across the river to Fort Lee, and he saw Washington there looking at the carnage going on at Fort Washington through his spyglass. And Everhart captures the moment. He says that Washington has tears in his eyes as he sees his men being bayoneted by Hessians. I mean, that's what Washington's Immortals captures. It's kind of the hidden war of the American Revolution. It's the stories of these men in their own words. And I think that's what makes this book very unique. It's a lot of the enlisted men that fought at the tip of the spear, the privates and the corporals, as well as the officers.
What happened to the Maryland Regiment after the war ended?
The Marylanders, like Washington, I think this is one of the great moments of the book. Washington, who has supreme power at the end of the war, is able to be a dictator if he wants to. But in the Maryland State House in 1783, in that winter, George Washington resigns his commission. The men of the Maryland line are all there with him, and they resign their commissions, and they hang up their swords and muskets and their uniforms, and they go back to civilian life. This is a book about citizen soldiers that serve their cause, and they go back to normal life. And my goal is to somehow bring, you know, I hope to, through this book, to raise awareness and bring the men of honor, family, and fortune home and find their mass grave in Brooklyn.
That's Patrick O'Donnell, a historian who's just written a book, Washington's Immortals, The Untold Story of an Elite Regiment Who Changed the Course of the Revolution. Patrick, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So many on the coasts are heading to the beaches this 4th of July weekend. You want to relax, go for a swim? Oh, knock it off. You have a better chance of being killed by a bee and a better chance of seeing a shark on the Discovery Channel's 28th annual Shark Week, which we're in the middle of. So how's it going? NPR TV critic Eric Deggans has been watching. Hi, Eric.
Hi, how's it going?
It's going just fine, except is it? You know, how is Shark Week going? You know, how? What do you think about it?
I'm here in Florida. I'm here in the home of sharks in some ways. And things are just fine, you know.
Yes.
As fun as Shark Week can be, and some people have even called it sort of another national holiday because they've been doing this for so long, it does hype up people's fears of sharks and their fears of being attacked, harmed, and even killed by them in a way that's just not realistic. There are some cool moments and a lot of really interesting information and even some promotion of conservation that happens, but it's right alongside, you know, I mean, the titles, you know, nuclear sharks, you know, shark bait, you know, it's yeah. Air Jaws, you know, there's so many references to Jaws and to the specter of the killer shark. There's one about, you know, is a shark a serial killer? You know,
to that point,
those are the things you have to take with a grain of salt.
To that point, a reviewer in Wired magazine is the one who said you're far more likely to be killed by bees, cars, sugar, fire, too much sunshine, pork, booze, or falling down a stair. Except that they are sensational animals. So here we've got a clip from this past Sunday's The Return of the Monster Mako. Let's listen.
When the moon hangs full, it's prime feeding time. And there's one predator out there that has eyes the size of saucers and teeth that will tear flesh from bone.
Okay, except that it's not likely to do that most of the time. You were saying before we started formally talking, Eric, that some researchers who were interviewed by Shark Week years ago, actually what they said was kind of changed somehow when it got on the air. You explain.
Well, there's been allegations that the producers of one Shark Week documentary in particular, the Voodoo Sharks, that they talked to researchers and led them to believe that they were doing a more conventional documentary. And then when it came out, they made it look like the researchers they talked to were trying to track down, you know, some ancient, you know, crazy, mythical shark that they really weren't chasing. Mm-hmm. And I think there was a point with Shark Week where the hype and the craziness of it reached kind of a peak. And this is when they were doing these fake documentaries about prehistoric sharks and making them seem like they, you know, were still existed. Megalodon is the most well-known one of those.
Well, actually, hold that thought because we have a clip from Megalodon. This is the mockumentary. In other words, there is no such thing. They're extinct, but let's listen.
Today, the consensus amongst the scientific community is that Megalodon is no longer alive, that it went extinct over 2 million years ago. However, detailed accounts of sightings suggest otherwise.
What? You mean they could exist? So they're not airing that. They're not airing that anymore, right?
Right. They decided, the head of Discovery Networks made a pledge a couple of years ago that they were going to roll back some of this stuff. So they did pull that mockumentary they're not airing as part of Shark Week, which actually infuriated some fans of Shark Week who really like those over-the-top documentaries. But the problem is that supposedly one of the points of Shark Week is to encourage conservation and get people involved in the efforts to save sharks. But when you have a week-long celebration and it ends on Sunday, that is focused so much on the dangers of these animals, you have to wonder how much that's helping conservation because people may want to see something dangerous, you know, sort of pass away or pass out of the ecosystem.
Yeah. Well, and by the way, we're well aware that there are increased shark sightings where we are along the East Coast because of warmer waters and seal movement, but that still doesn't amount to, you know, the fear that people have of sharks.
Well, that's why I think it's more important than ever that Shark Week get back to basics and sort of give people actual information. Because it's not as if the risk is non-existent. And there are things that people can do to lessen their chances of coming in contact with them or being attacked by them. And I like to see that kind of stuff and maybe a little less of the sensationalism.
Or you can watch Shark Week through the fingers over your eyes.
Now, there is, if you want, there is a great show called Shark Sanity, right?
Okay.
That airs on Saturday that gives you the best of the Shark Week programming for the week before. And there's something airing on Friday night called Blue Serengeti that talks about, you know, a very fertile area in California that has a lot of sharks. And it's been compared to the area in Africa in terms of how the sharks hunt and the fact that there's so much going on there with predator and prey.
I thought you were going to say it's about sharks in the Serengeti of Africa. No, no.
It's about an ancient prehistoric shark that has somehow managed to come out on land. No, thank God.
NPR TV critic Eric Deggans. Eric, thanks, and happy 4th.
Same to you.